down through there.
Do you remember when it first started up?
Well, I was in 47, 48, and it had a real bad years, you know. But I didn't go up there about 10 years later. There's a fellow named George Neal.
Yeah, people have suggested I go talk with him.
He's having trouble with his head or something. He had a head injury in his mall, but he's taking some kind of medicine for it. But see him, he probably tell a lot about it, because he was there from the time it started to, well, just a few years ago. We got done just
where does he live?
Well, up in Warren. You go up in Warren and turn to go into Warren Village. And then the first left, it'll take you up to go up Warren, Roxbury Mountain. You go up there, and just you come to foot the hill, there's a house on the, your right. Right foot the hill, and I think it's a yellow house. There's a house there, but a connecting to a double connecting garage. And he lives there. Would you like his phone number? He might not be there. You might be able to have phone ahead, or you get to call.
I'll call ahead next week, maybe.
You want his phone number or something?
I've got one of those Warren books, so
okay.
I can look.
The name is George Neal.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because others have suggested him too.
Yeah, he could tell you about Manor and stuff.
Because that's another whole area that I've got to. Yeah. Like I was going to go see.
Just asking us what the going price was. He said, my grandfather heard what you got. He says, he wised me up. He says, I'm going to charge accordingly. So he got to be a millionaire out of what land he had, because he had it all over the place.
That's what I heard.
And he took it in for grocery bills. But he says, my grandfather didn't catch on. He says, he found out what you sold yours for. He says, the rest of them were selling it for, you know, just a few hundred or a few thousand.
So he got people paid up in terms of land for grocery bills.
Yeah,
a lot of them. And he was able to sell it.
Yeah, because he had land all over. A lot of times they'd have a bill, they'd pay tax on the thing or that. So they'd ask him about selling up a bill, and deed him over a piece of land or something. That's what a lot of them did in the war. Carl Long got locked that way too.
And that was during the war?
During the Depression.
During the Depression. Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, several years ago, I bought this place $600, I guess it was.
Well, this was when you came home from the war, right?
On the way in. I had 5 days at home, and I bought this place.
Yeah.
And then after the war, I bought the other one over there. And the two places I paid $1,800 for. The two places I paid 140 acres, and there's a house and barn here, and there's a house and several barns over there.
And this was at Henry Perkins?
No, I still own the one down at Henry Perkins. This on the hill.
Oh.
I bought that early part of the war when I came home from California, and then I went into service. 42, and then I bought this over across from where the trailers are. My daughter lives over there now.
Mm-hmm.
The two of them made 140 acres, and then the two elders, the windows been all smashed out of here, and everything, the kids getting smashed, the windows and the doors, so we had to fix those up. And had the other, and over at the other place, I had to tear down, there's two, well, the barns fell in, there's two barns like my old barn out here, and 30 or 40 barns, they're hooked together. And then there's another barn off one side, they had for horse barn. And there's an addition on the end of the main house. It's just the main house left now. So that was for the summer kitchen. And on the end of that, they had a wood shed, and a kind of a carriage shed. And the shed is all closed in for the others, except for a small door. They had a sheep shed, pigs, and chickens, and that all added out. And they must have went at least 60 or 70 feet from the main house. And in between that and the barn parallel to the road, the horse barn. And the others was a big corn barn. You could drive a car or something into. And of course, I was broke. I got out of service to try to get started here. So, I was going to try to save all the sheds and stuff over there, but the roofs all rotted away, the sills and everything. I couldn't save them. And that house is, at least the first story is made out of 6x12 hewn timbers. And it was covered over with clapboards, and then later on, one of my neighbors put on, it lived there, put on a shingle. And this one, when the other, it used to be, like I said, it used to be three barns in U-shape. And the barn like this, and then there was another one went right angles to it. It was a horse barn. And then there's another barn like a scale barn that you could take about 8-10
But the horses. Land goes so it's off like, pretty steep,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Well, it's a fair level there. So it made a U-shape. And it was open to the east, but the rest of it made up a sort of barnyard, like, and it protected the cattle in the wintertime, except from a northeaster on this, come out of the east. And well, I just managed to save this. The others are down and gone. I just managed to save this, and it was going fast.
I bet.
But
when do you figure that was originally built?
Back in 1800 somewhere. I checked house back, I think, to 1831, and I'm trying to read the deed. I haven't finished looking yet. I haven't been able to read this last one. It's quite a job to follow the deeds back.
Yeah.
You have maybe one family, like a Richardson or something, and they'll deed it to maybe three or four of their children or brothers or in the family, and then they'll deed it to somebody else, deed it back, and you chase yourself in a circle part of the time. So, and there's different families that had a lot of, well, property around here. There was the Richardsons and the Bairds and Jocelyns and the Maxwells. Well, that was on my mother's side. There were several Maxwells that owned there. One of them used to own across from where the den is down there in Waitsfield. Another owned a place just below the, what used to call the Dugway, just below there. And my father had a cousin living on, over where they called Beckeridge, or did call it.
Just called what?
Beckeridge. It's just before you, almost across from a state shed lot there where they get the gravel and stuff. And, well, it was my grandmother, I think, was born over on the old Tucker Hill,
mm-hmm.
up there about 1840 or 50. And
now, was this your grandmother?
Livingston Maxwell before she was married. And the Livingstons, I guess, come down from Canada. And, well, I don't know how long on my mother's side, on her mother's side, my grandmother's side, is Sherman. And if you want to see Sherman, just go over to Duxbury Hills. And I'm related to pretty near all of them. Some of them were born, grew up, and died, and I never met, you know. But
now, did they all sing too? Were they all singers?
I don't know. They used to visit back and forth quite a lot. But I remember my mother and her sister, they used to lit an organ and sing quite, you know,
now,
when they
this
got together.
Is the sister in Brattleboro you're talking about?
It's my mother's sister, my aunt.
The one that's in Brattleboro, the one that lived up at Berlin Corners.
Yeah, she loved to sing too. She liked to get together with my mother and that, and they'd get singing some different ones. Of course, later on, they didn't so much, you know, each had their families and stuff, got separated. But I remember when I was small, and they would once in a while get together. Yeah.
And your mother played the organ, or your aunt?
Well, both of them did. Of course, after we sold that organ before we went to Toledo, we never had another one in the house. But before that, mother did. Of course, I was small and probably 8-9 years old, and I remember that. I was about 9 when I sold that organ. I told you about it, the bells and the chimes and everything else on it. I've never seen one since.
Where
it was
did,
a beautiful
where did they
organ.
Get that?
Huh?
Where did that come from, the organ?
My folks bought it somewhere, and it's from around here. But I think it's made in Vermont, but somewhere, but I don't remember, but it's the only one I ever saw with the chimes and the bells and everything on it. You could blend in with the thing after you learn to play it.
An Esty organ? They used to make
those I don't remember. See, I was only 8-9 years old. But that time, most of them were, you had was made in the state here.
Yeah.
But it's the only one that kind I ever knew had the chimes and the bells on it. They could blend that in with it. I don't know how it was done, but I remember remember they're doing it. Yeah, mother used to just, most of the thing just, you know, was, fell. So yeah, I used to sing by myself. I mean, I'd get a spell and I'd set up half a night and play the Victrola. I think used to drive my folks nuts, but I didn't have very often. But I did play it not more than any of the rest, all the rest put together, I think.
When did you start writing songs?
Just in the mood that hit me, way back.
When you were a kid, or?
Well, time I was in high school or something. Sometimes I'd done them before. But I've got some I've never finished out.
Would you make up the tune, or would you
I might have heard it, but I always figured I made it up, but yeah. You can't tell, you know.
Yeah.
In the back of your mind somewhere. Those, that, as far as I know, on the back farm and the others, just tunes I made up myself. So those others, I knew the words, I heard them, and
Did your mother used to make up songs?
No, I don't think so. I think I was the one that did that. I used to, other people, they'll go out and drive and play the radio. Well, I don't. I get driving something by, I'll use that to sing myself. I usually don't want anybody with me. In fact, I've done more here than I have all the rest of my life just since you've been around.
Well, that's good, see.
I think you got me into a bad habit.
No, I think it's a great habit.
I used to do it just myself. When somebody's with me, I don't. I once in a while, I guess has to hear me singing something down in the cellar or something, but otherwise I don't. I I'm kind of a loner. I think maybe I am. You know, it's not always something I can, like, visit with you or something and that, but I like times and I just like to be myself, and it doesn't bother me. When I worked upon the mountain, I'd have a I didn't mind being alone, but I'd have a day off and I'd come back. Some fellows would be pretty near wild. They had to spend all day up there, nobody talked to or nothing else, and read all day. That never bothered me. It still doesn't.
Yeah, I think some people really enjoy it, and it gives you a chance to think. Mm-hmm. And
when we have a family reunion, we just had them last few years because my aunt and uncle, they're up near, well, pretty near 90, both of them. I'll go and mix in for an hour or so, and then I want to get away. I get away for maybe an hour, and then I'll go back to Nesville. But after an hour or so, I just want to get away. Kind of be by myself for a while.
Well, you always enjoyed the woods, too, didn't you?
Well, I like the woods, all right, yeah. Back when I was younger, I used to just take off and hike. Last time I used to run, I'd run for miles when I was younger. Time I got out of the service, that was all gone. Of course, I think probably I lost that in the service. I don't have any wind at all now, and that bothers me, because when you don't have any wind, you get, you know, things you can't do. I mean, you know, when I got out of the service, I just got out, come home with you. Farther than I was, I can hit up here on the hill. We got that first pitch down here, about where the blacktop ends. He always claimed he didn't have any wind, but he got up there and he was hardly puffing. I had to stop two or three times and rest. And before I went in, I could run up the hill.
That's amazing.
Of course, I caught scrub typhus, and I don't know if that's what did it or not. Putting me in hospital for 3 months. They said it took a year's complete rest to cure it, but. I went and got back in the outfit 3 months. They wanted to send me to a rest camp, but I laid a little bit and got back into the outfit. And I met a fellow later, my squadron I was in, who was after shipping. They like just 40,000 tons being credited with 1 million tons of shipping either damaged or sunk during the war on the Japanese. And they flew nights. And they... one of the few radar planes, instead of the ball turret, they had the radar that let up down to check the radar. And the official thing was to go in over a battleship or cruiser at night, 5,000 feet. But the radar worked better at 1,500, so that's why they went in. And we lost our ship found out 6 weeks so before the war ended. And we just changed all the engines and had about 12 hours on it, and it went out and didn't come back. And after the war ended, we found out why. It was three fellows that was in it ended up in the outfit for just about an hour and they shipped them right back out. They'd went out to the Yangtze River, made one pass, and they come around for another at night. The pilot come in too low and hooked the wingtip in the water and they cartwheeled.
Oh.
And the Chinese communists picked up three of them, of the 11-man crew. Most cruisers was 10, but they had 11 with a radar man. And so my crew chief see him, but I didn't. He speak to him just before they went out. I said, oh, the engines were working perfect. We'd always worried there's something, you know, we hadn't done or hadn't done right or something. Because the last year of the war, well, we were supposed to get more help and stuff, and it didn't turn out that way.
Mm-hmm.
There used to be five of us to a ship, a ground crew working on it. I was the crew chief. Ended up there just the two of us, and they had a lot of replacements from the States. Well, they got all their ratings from drill field or supply office or something, and they come over. And what they do, we had to do the day maintenance. Well, it's pretty hard to do it all, because before we had a man for each engine, there's four engines, and the crew chief looked after the other part of the plane. That wasn't too bad. Who needs to come to engine change who did that? So they did the day maintenance. It was just the crew chief and I do the same work. It used to be five.
Mm.
But when it came to an engine change, plug change and stuff like that, 100 hours, engine change every 400 hours. We had to have these new ones. And, well, that wasn't much relief because you had to go around and try to do your work and watch theirs and be sure it's all checked out right. So you'd be pretty near exhausted, you know, from trying to keep up all that. So that was really from the last year of the war. And our officers were the same. They came over in the States, too. They looked at, before that, our officers looked out for the men, and the men looked out for the officers. But after that, it was more or less every man for himself. They also looked at that, and same with the others. So.
Mm.
And they come over all the ratings. And I pretty got court-martialed with that. I wrote a letter to send out. I didn't pay attention to who the censor was. Well, the CO himself, and that was after our old ones left, you know. This one's about as two-faced as ever it was, and he got it. And I'm paying attention to it. The next morning after I sent it out, the first sergeant come around and says, you can pair of fatigues. We used to wear short shoes and a cap, and that was about a working outfit. So you better put on a pair of fatigues, and CO wants to see you about 8 o'clock. So I got in, and then I went and get suspicious. So I went down and checked to see who the censor was, and it's him, so I knew what was coming. I got in there, and I didn't like him very well, so I didn't even salute him. And he went on about that letter. I told him that if you worked in a mess hall or something like that, you get more ratings than the fellows on the line. I said, some of them been over here for 2 years, they're crew chiefs. I said, they're still corporals. And I said, a crew chief is supposed to be a tech or a master sergeant. And I knew one fellow, he'd been there, had been a corporal for 22 months, and the crew chief for 17 is still a corporal. And so yeah, I could see he was mad. He's so mad he was shaking, you know. He started, I told him, I said, anybody, I said, the black market and thing, I said, anybody get more ratings in the mess hall? I says, through the officers, I says, through the black market or something, and the ones on the line. He didn't like that. He wanted me right at the door. I did shake it a little bit so I'd get through. But he didn't dismiss me, but he was mad and I didn't salute him. All we had was some palm frauds up for about shoulder high, and everybody see what was going on like here all over the orderly room. Well, of course, everybody could hear all these fellows listening, and they could hear what went on. So in the afternoon, I went out the line again. About 10 days later, the ratings come out, and the fellows on the line, engineers that, you know, worked on the planes, A lot of them hadn't had a rating in a year. And about 10 days later, they come out. And about 8 or 10 of them got another strike. And we was coming in at noon and on the 6x6, you know, a big truck, and riding in, one fellow tapped me on the shoulder. I was out looking. And he'd been in Pearl Harbor at the barracks the day of Pearl Harbor. And instruction and everything. And the first thing afterwards, they sent back to the States. He said, no more landed in the States. They turned around and sent back to Australia. And he said, you know, he says, as long as you're in this outfit, he says, you're never going to get another strike. He says, but we all know who got us one. He says, well, thanks anyway. He says, but you'll never get one. Because they all heard that. Went through the outfit. I practically blackmailed the CO because I think about they're getting the black market in there, some of their supplies. And I think he figured I'd blackmail him, mail him a little bit, so he'd better give out some stripes. He did. I didn't get it, but about 8 or 10 others did. He said, "We all," he says, "you won't get one. We all know who got us one," he said. And he'd been over a long time. He hadn't had a strike for a long time either.
You must have been pretty popular.
I got along with the officers all right, if you're a good officer. Otherwise, our coochie and I are known as a couple of outlaws. You know, the last day of the war, we was working another plane. They were just shifting one plane to another. And I remember I had a splitting headache. And there had been rumors all day about the war, and then ending, you know. And I finish up my work, step back, and then Coochie, he step back. He asked me, he says, you all done? I said, yeah. He said, well, I guess that's all we can do. Just after that, we just stood there, you know. Just after that, they come up in the weapons carrier, the combat crew, and get out. And they were all quiet, you know, but the skipper, the first pilot, went and started talking to Coochie. When the crew came over and started talking to me, and he was all wound up. And he started talking, so well, he said, we're going out tonight, war over or not, there's going to be two planes going up that night. He said, war over or not, he says, we're going to have that other 40,000 ton. He says, they don't give us a citation of just one squadron out of a group of four. They won't give just a single one a presidential citation, but because they were all after land targets except our one squadron. He said, we'll get that. He says, they'll have to give us one. He said, we'll go out 10 miles. He says, everything's going out. He says, you ain't going to hear from us till we get back. War over or not. He says, we go out, and he says, we find 5,000 tonners and ship, sink them. On the way home, we said, home is the 10,000 tonners. He says, nothing to sink them with. He says, and everything's heading for Japan. He says, we can find them all right. Tonight, he says, between the two ships, he says, you won't hear from us till we get back. And he says, well, he says, skipper was sure pleased, and he said, he see who was working on his plane. But he told us, he says, you treat those fellows right. He says, I'll have your bucks. He says, the war is pretty near over. And he says, I don't want no accidents. You know, it made me feel kind of embarrassed. I said, I said, we wouldn't do that to you fellows. You see the reputation we had. Yeah. And about that time, somebody hollered at him, get aboard. They was pulling out. He got on, and they pulled out. And a few minutes later, we got picked up. We go back to camp, and when they were just going on the truck, see the first plane take off. Yeah, our plane, the one we'd worked on, started down the runway, got about halfway down, chopped the power and stopped. The other plane came around, circled around the land, and we stopped what they call a engineer shack, line shack. And they come out, a couple of them, and the others are going to stay there. And they said, we just got on the radio that all the missions are scrubbed till further notice, and the war is over. So that's what we heard.
Boy, that must have been something.
But you know, they didn't celebrate. We used to. I've heard about all the big celebrations that went on here in the States. It wasn't like that in our outfit. I don't remember a thing, Don. I know I had a sick headache. later in the evening, it's died down some. And we used to put on a shirt and pictures in, I mean, night, usually earlier before the mosquito stuff had cooled down a little. I remember the fellas forming groups and visits, you know, and break up and form others. It was that way all over camp.
And where were you?
Aishima.
Oh, you were.
And I know that it was four. It was just about dark. And some of the fellows you knew and some didn't. A lot have been in and out. Some of them were pre-servicemen before the war. And I was talking with, I know, one or two of them and another fellow. We heard a carbine fired right by us, probably 6 foot away. One fellow, big rugged fellow, he says, they want to fire, he says. And he said, what did you fire that for? He says, well, it's celebrating. And he said, well, don't fire it again. The fellow says, I will if I want to. He says, you fire that again, I'll wrap that piece around your head. Well, he went all bumbling, but he was smart because he would have. It was a new replacement. And just before that, we'd heard him miss a small arms fire. And someone said, I wonder what that is. And one of us said, I don't know. I don't want their all the shooting about. And next day, we heard it was over in Okinawa. And there's a bunch of replacements come in. I heard the war was over. They all started firing in the air and stuff. And during the process, six of them got killed and about 20 of them got wounded. Just stupid.
Were you there when the bombs were dropped over Nagasaki? And
well, we was in some of the places. But they used to make, they made a raid there at the last raid they made at Aishima. Just weeks before the war ended. All the fellows, I've been over a long time, so you got, so you figure it wasn't your time anyway. So all of them, I've been there longer than most of them. And all of them went bailing out of the tent, heading for Foxhole. And we had one fellow been over there just a week or so in our tent. And I heard him say, where's Livingston? What happened to Livingston? He get hit? And I heard one fellow say, no. He says, he's all right. Well, he says, he get hit or something? Where is he? I found out, he's in there sacking out. He says, don't worry. He says, if it gets close enough, he'll be out. So I went back to sleep, and they stayed out in the foxhole all night. They were dead in the morning. I got a good night's sleep out of it. I figured they didn't the chaps get hit pretty close to what they wanted. So I didn't worry too much about them.
Well, how about the atomic bombs? Where were you then?
I was in Aishima. I think that's where it was. Yeah. I think we come up from Clark Field. But, of course, we didn't hear about that right off. But later, our outfit flew they made what they call a B-32. About the same time they come out with the B-29. But the 32 was a bigger plane than the B-24 we worked on. Carry a heavier load, and is a and our squadron was the only one ever flew them in combat. We got three of them. And they had the reversed propellers, where you could reverse the pitches, stop them quicker. Well, they had trouble with the brakes. And I was down Clark Field when I first came in, and one of them burned out the brakes. And they got fixed, and they'd pulled into a revetment there. I taught one of the crewmen on it, and afterwards he was laughing. He said he sat up top of the hatch, had it all open. And it had just had a beer issue somewhere, and he says, fellow off to one side, he says, he's drinking a can of beer. He said, they put the props in reverse, and the plane started backing up. He says, the fellow lowered the thing and looked at the plane. He took another sip and lowered it again. He said, the plane is still backing, and he threw it all off through the beer can. He'd never seen him back up before. But they just used them, I guess. I don't know if they even flew them in Aishima, but they had them up Clark Field. Just a few of them, our own squadron flew them. But they weren't for the high levels and more for low level, lower level bombing.
That must have been